From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez introduced a major new government program Wednesday to deal with the poverty, unemployment, and tuition debt facing young people in that country. Calling the initiative the Support for Students Program of Argentina, she said, quote, "We are consolidating a system of social security unprecedented in our history," closed quote. Fernandez said the program was targeting youth 18 to 24 who are not yet students, do not have jobs, or have only informal work. The plan includes formal legislative recognition of the value of education. It will pay young people a support payment of 600 pesos a month and will cover 500,000 young people aged 18 to 24 years. Accompanied by legislators, cabinet ministers, and representatives of unions and social organizations, Fernandez said the new program will benefit 78% of the young people who are unemployed and in the two lowest income levels within Argentina. During the announcement, Fernandez confirmed that Argentina will attend the second summit of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, or CELAC, to be held in Havana later this month. Ecuador's President Rafael Correa said Wednesday he would ask the United States to withdraw American military personnel assigned to its embassy in Quito. Correa said he became aware of what he described as an oversized U.S. military presence at the embassy after learning that four U.S. military personnel were aboard an Ecuadorian military helicopter that came under fire last October near the border with Colombia. He said, quote, "That's when we learned of all of this, of the military group, nearly 50 military personnel. Unfortunately, these people have been so infiltrated in all sectors that what is scandalous appears normal," closed quote. Correa said Quito was already taking measures to address the issue. Back in 2007, Correa said the U.S. would have to let Ecuador open a military base in Miami if Washington wanted to keep using an air base it had on Ecuador's Pacific coast. He said, quote, "If there's no problem having foreign soldiers on a country's soil, surely you'll let us have an Ecuadorian base in the United States," closed quote. Then President George W. Bush never responded to the request, and Ecuador ultimately refused to renew Washington's lease on the Manta Air Base, which expired in 2009. We'll have more with our reporter from Managua, Nicaragua, Tony Solo, later in the program. It's on again, off again, and now, on again. According to the latest reports, direct talks between the Syrian government and the armed groups that have been waging war there for nearly 3 years will happen Saturday. Early Friday, reports from the UN were that the two sides would meet. This early report was from Deanne Penn.
Delegations of the Syrian government and the opposition are expected to meet face-to-face in Geneva on Friday to start talks to end the crisis in their country. The three-year conflict has claimed the lives of more than 100,000 people and left 11 million others in need of humanitarian assistance. On Wednesday, a conference was held in the Swiss resort of Montreux as the United Nations continued its effort to get the Syrian parties to end the fighting in the country. The UN and Arab League envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, has been meeting with both delegations separately before bringing them to the same room on Friday. He warned that he was under no illusion that it would be easy. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
But when we spoke several hours later with Mustafa Afzalzadeh, our correspondent on the ground at the talks in Switzerland, things had changed.
The first thing that happened during the Geneva II talks was the press conference heading the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He asked the participants to speak limitedly so everyone can make their comments. So he asked the Russians and Russian representative Mr. Lavrov and John Kerry to make their comments in, I think it was about 8 minutes or 6 minutes. So Mr. Lavrov started speaking and he finished in 6 minutes. And then John Kerry, he finished in time. and Walid Muallim, you know, the head of the Syrian delegation, started speaking, but he didn't finish in the time that Ban Ki-moon said. And Ban Ki-moon told him that we asked you to finish in time, in like, I think it was 12 minutes. Walid Muallim responded that I'm living in Syria, and if anyone has to speak about Syria, it's me. You live in the United States. The others don't, even the opposition don't live in Syria. So if there is any information going to be given out about Syria, it has to be by me that I'm living in Syria. So and after that, you know, the opposition spoke, and after him, the representatives of like 40 countries and four or five organizations. The interesting thing about the guests and the countries that were invited to the conference was that I even asked this from, I even told this to John Kerry when his press conference finished at night. I told him, if you Google or search the name of these countries plus Syria, you would get no results. They don't have anything to do with Syria. These countries have been invited to legitimize, you know, the Geneva II talks. So this was the at the end of the night, you know, there was a press conference by Ban Ki-moon, and after that there was a press conference by John Kerry, and after that we had the last press conference by the Syrian delegation. The important thing is the questions that were asked by, you know, the media that could ask the questions from Ban Ki-moon and John Kerry were decided before the press conference, and it wasn't an open press conference. No, there were many medias available, but only the medias that they asked, and it was mostly like Reuters and Western medias. The one important thing that happened during the press conferences was the Syrian representative that was speaking for the press conference. He had lots of documents saying that we have warned from 2 years ago, and we've sent, like he said, like 20 kilograms of paper, official documents and letters we've sent to the United Nations, but there has been no replies about the terrorism in Syria. He said that we have lots of documents, you know, the name of people, the nationalities and stuff like that, we've given out to the United Nations, but they don't pay any attention to that. The next day of the talks was a holiday, so there wasn't anything going on. It was just, you know, private meetings between Akhzar Ibrahimi and the two parts. And now today is the third day of the talks. It started from the third day of the talks have been scheduled at 9 o'clock, to start at 9 o'clock, but it was postponed to 11 o'clock. And the first thing that happened was Akhzar Ibrahimi had a meeting with the Syrian delegation, the government that represent the government, and then it was scheduled to have a meeting with the opposition, and it has to be done around now. But it seems that the head of the opposition group has left Switzerland. What they're asking for is, they're saying that we only speak to the Syrian government delegation face to face when the United Nations gets a written approval that Syrian delegation has accepted Geneva I agreements. So it seems that there won't be things going on tomorrow. It's going to be finished tonight with the press conference that Akhzar Ibrahimi is going to have in 1 or 2 hours.
Now, the latest reports late Friday from the UN and other media say that the government and the insurgents have agreed to meet face-to-face on Saturday. Daniel Dickinson reports from Geneva.
Delegations of the Syrian government and opposition have agreed to meet in the same room for the first time in Geneva on Saturday. The announcement was made by the joint United Nations Arab League envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, after meeting both delegations on Friday. The talks to end the three-year conflict in Syria started in Montreux earlier in the week before moving to Geneva.
The discussions I've had with the two parties were encouraging, and we are looking forward to our meetings tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon.
Lakhdar Brahimi is leading global diplomatic efforts to end the conflict that has claimed more than 100,000 lives and displaced millions of others. The UN Arab League envoy hopes to get the Syrian parties to agree on a political solution that will bring lasting peace to the country. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych has promised a government reshuffle and amendments to the anti-protest laws that triggered violent clashes in Kiev. Yanukovych has also offered to release those detained during the riots with mitigated penalties for protesters arrested during the clashes. Friday saw no major fighting in Kiev for the first time this week. Protesters didn't provoke police with attacks, but they weren't standing by idly either. Various reports showed them strengthening barricades and building new ones, and moving their encampments closer to the presidential headquarters. Fierce fighting did break out in Cairo between a few thousand supporters of deposed Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and Egyptian security forces. This happened hours after a suicide bomber attacked a major police compound in the capital. According to various reports, several other police stations suffered bomb attacks shortly thereafter. Fighting also took place on the road that leads to the pyramids of Giza. Some Morsi supporters burned tires and hurled petrol bombs at security forces, who responded by firing tear gas. Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood has sharply condemned the attacks. We have this report from Press TV's Omaleski.
A deadly day in Egypt. Three bomb explosions targeting security forces in the capital, Cairo, and nearby cities claim several lives. The first blast took place outside Cairo's police headquarters. Reports say it was followed by gunmen firing on the buildings there. At least four people are now confirmed dead and over 70 others injured. Hours later, another bombing targeted police vehicles near a metro station in the capital city. Egyptian media say one police officer was killed and several others were injured in that attack. A third bomb went off near a police station in Giza, southwest of the capital, with no casualties. Meanwhile, Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood has condemned the attacks against security forces. Let's get more now from our correspondent, Mohammed Chalabi, with us from Cairo with the latest. Mohammed, who would want to target the security forces? And now with the Muslim Brotherhood clearly condemning these attacks, is that being seen as a response to allegations that it is behind terrorist attacks or bombings in the country?
Well, you're just raising the question, Homa, that everybody is wondering about here in Egypt. We know that the rival claims exist and continue. The military-backed government accuses the Muslim Brotherhood of being behind those attacks and of at least giving political cover to these attacks, although nothing has been judicially proven, and although the Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis group that was behind a recent wave of terrorist attacks in Sinai and in the Qahliya announced responsibility for Friday's early morning attack that targeted the police Cairo headquarters and that left four dead, four citizens dead, and 76 injured, according to the latest numbers from the health ministry. And 68 of those injured have already left hospital, so it seems that the toll is not likely to rise. At the same time, the Brotherhood and its allies, and even those from the liberal stream, accuse the government, this interim government, of trying to frame the opposition and of practicing Mubarak era style, the Mubarak era inner killings style. Where is the truth? Well, I guess it's anybody's guess. But how will this affect the situation in Egypt? I guess is the major question here. And will this make some liberal forces, for instance, or sympathizers, distance themselves from the Brotherhood because they are at least being facing some sort of so-called popular indictment, if you will? I mean, those diehard supporters of the country's de facto ruler, General Sisi, the defense minister, who has hinted that he might run for presidential elections, could get a boost from this, and this could get his supporters to be even more, hawkish. Will this cause for a more crackdown? Will this lead to more crackdowns, as if the crackdown against the anti-coup protesters is not, already brutal enough or inhumane, according to the eyes of many here in Egypt. And what will this mean, for the rival, for anticipated rival protests? I guess this is another question, because you have the two camps here in Egypt, both wanting to go, the Brotherhood and its allies, the 6th of April and other forces want to celebrate the, on the occasion of the third anniversary of the 25th of Jan revolution that ousted longtime dictator Hosni Mubarak, they want to take to the streets again. They say the military dictatorship, is back in Egypt, while the other side wants to celebrate the passing of the constitutional referendum and the advancement of the roadmap, that army-imposed roadmap that accompanied the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood's Morsi. So, Homa, very, very, very complicated situation here in Egypt. We already have finally news of the death of a protester in New Damietta. So, you already have here the crackdown against the anti-coup protesters has started very early, as the Friday prayer has just ended some 10 or 15 minutes ago here in Egypt.
And now, our week's end report with news from the land south of El Rio Grande from our correspondent in Nicaragua, Tony Solo.
One very important development today is going to be the meeting of the three countries currently members of the CELAC Troika, the kind of the group of three countries that are guiding the CELAC programs. That CELAC is the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. They have, I think it's their second major summit at the end of this month in Havana, Cuba. And the countries that have been coordinating the implementation of the agreement of the first summit, held about a year ago, were Cuba, Costa Rica, and Chile. Cuba will be handing over its pro tempore presidency to Costa Rica. But the way that the Troika works is that in order to maintain a high level of consensus about the implementation of CELAC agreements, the arrangement is that the country that held the pro tempore presidency prior to the current year, plus the current country, plus the country that will be taking up the pro tempore presidency in the year to come, they work together in any activities designed to promote the implementation of CELAC agreements. And we saw that last year, for example, with the visit to the People's Republic of China of the CELAC Troika that consisted of Chile, Cuba, and Costa Rica.
Yeah, that's good, because it ensures continuity, doesn't it?
Yeah, it ensures continuity, and it also ensures that no one country can be accused of somehow not complying with the wishes of the community of the overall community of states. One interesting thing about the meeting today, which I think will be held in Havana, is that attending the meeting will be St. Vincent and the Grenadines, a relatively small Caribbean island nation. And again, that reflects on what we've noted in the past about the Latin American and Caribbean institutions that have been developed and that have been developed over the last few years, namely that the size of the country concerned isn't taken into account. So St. Vincent and the Grenadines presumably will be the country that will be taking over from Costa Rica in 2015.
Huh.
So I just thought that, I just think that's a really noteworthy characteristic of the way the community of Latin American and Caribbean states is set up, that all countries have an equal voice no matter what their size.
Yeah, the structure seems to encourage consensus, like you said, you know.
So yeah, that's happening today. The conference itself starts, I think, on the 27th, the 29th. That's only what, 3 days away, or something like that. So that summit is likely to highlight various themes that you and I have been talking about for the last couple of years, really. on these programs. The steady move towards regional integration across ideological boundaries throughout South America, Central America, and the Caribbean. And one of the kind of accessory characteristics that it'll be interesting to see at this next summit of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, whether it gets any coverage in the Western, in North American and European media, because virtually none of the other activities relating to Latin American, Caribbean and Central American integration get any coverage at all, despite their huge importance for the world economy and for world, for international relations at a global level in general.
You know, let me interrupt you there on that point, because, you know, if you think about journalists sitting up here in New York shivering our behinds off today, it's like 8 degrees outside or something. The idea of spending, you know, a long weekend or a week in Havana right now, just in and of itself, is extremely attractive. And, you know, the article that you forwarded me about CELAC, they have internet access and TV transmission capability there for journalists that come down to cover it. And so it sounds to me like, you know, where do I sign? And yet, you know, you're right. There will be very little coverage. If you look at the agenda, the fight against hunger, poverty, and inequality, and to declare the region a zone of peace and free of nuclear weapons. Maybe that's why.
Yeah, there are all kinds of little news tidbits that we can look at, if you like, over the last week. For example, one that you sent me earlier was the decision by President Rafael Correa of Ecuador to ask United States military personnel to leave the U.S. embassy in Quito, Ecuador's capital.
Yeah,
and that's another little move by a sovereign country in Latin America to make clear to the United States that it can't just do what it likes. In their territory, and it's a small move, but a very significant one.
It's an interesting one because apparently, the Ecuadorian government was unaware of the fact that rather than having a staff of 4 or 5 military attachés to protect the embassy there in Quito, there were 50, and they were engaged in combat near the border with Colombia. And that's what triggered the incident.
Yeah, and so, you know, and that's completely beyond the pale in terms of international relations.
Yeah.
It's so typical of United States diplomacy, the State Department of U.S. Southern Command, to just do what they like and not pay attention to any of the normal rules that they themselves would expect other countries to abide by.
Yeah, imagine the Russians flying sorties against Canada from inside the United States without telling anybody in Washington.
Right. So another aspect that's very important about the CELAC summit is that the progressive governments, for example, the governments of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas, that's Cuba, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Venezuela, of course, Dominica, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and Antigua and Barbuda from the Caribbean, and Bolivia. And those governments, and also their allied governments, if you like, or very sympathetic governments of President Dilma Rousseff in Brazil and President Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, they pay a lot of attention to what their popular movements and what social organizations are anxious about, and about the concerns of organizations that are active around social issues, around environmental issues. And that's in stark contrast to other countries like, for example, Mexico or Colombia, Peru, Chile certainly. And there are also a few tidbits in the news over the last few days. For example, in Mexico, grassroots environmental organizations are talking about organizing a major campaign against the consequences of the Mexican government's privatization policy that the Mexican government recently managed to push through, a privatization program affecting Mexico's state oil company Pemex. And there's a lot of protest around that. In a similar country like Guatemala, which is Mexico's southern neighbor, there's active protest going on around water rights and the privatization of water. And so whereas in countries like Bolivia and Venezuela, Ecuador, there's more openness to discussion. In countries like Mexico and Guatemala, those kinds of protests tend to be in subject to general, quite brutal repression. And I know that critics of the governments of Evo Morales and Rafael Correa, particularly in relation to indigenous and environmental issues, and radical critics of those governments will say, oh, well, you know, and that's just not true. Evo Morales and Rafael Correa and their respective governments are also quite ruthless in their repression of dissent. But that's a complete distortion of the way protest is managed, for example, in Ecuador and Bolivia, in such sharp comparison to the way protest is managed in Chile, Mexico, or Colombia, for example.
Also, of the rights of and the relationship between the indigenous peoples in those countries, and, you know, like, say, for example, in Bolivia, where, you know, Evo Morales is an indigenous Bolivian, and you have instead in Mexico what's going on, that one of the core protests is that the privatization is of indigenous lands that's being sold off to multinationals.
Yeah, and of course the whole Zapatista movement is built around indigenous demands for fair treatment and access to resources to be able to develop their communities in the way that they want to. And, you know, the insistence on autonomy. And if you take Venezuela or Nicaragua, for example, as example of other countries, and they have very advanced policies in relation to indigenous autonomy. In Nicaragua, for example, and back in the 80s, largely as a result of the difficulties caused on the Caribbean coast, Nicaragua's Caribbean coast, by the Ronald Reagan-sponsored terrorist war against the Sandinista government back then. The Nicaraguan authorities worked closely with indigenous people on Nicaragua's Caribbean coast to develop an autonomy project, and that autonomy project passed into law, I think it was back in 1987, if I remember right. And that autonomy law has been developed subsequently. It was pretty much a dead letter all through the 90s as a result of the neoliberal policies of the government in power at that time. But since Daniel Ortega and his Sandinista colleagues took office in 2007 again, they reactivated the autonomy project. And for example, they've given indigenous peoples security, land security title, secure land title to something like 30,000 square hectares of land altogether, and that's an ongoing process, but it's not one that you're likely to see anywhere in Mexico or Colombia, for example.
Or the United States either, for that matter, with the res in the United States.
Yeah, in fact, in Nicaragua, the Caribbean coast elections should be held, and I think they're held at the end of this month. At the end of next month. I think it's the last week of February that they're held. And there's something like 15 or 16 political parties taking part in those elections. It'll be interesting to see what the result is, because over the last few years, the Sandinistas, who historically have been looked at askance by the populations of Nicaragua's Caribbean coast in terms of political representation, have been making steady gains in terms of electoral support, so they should do quite well in those February elections.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.